We'll give you some context on the economic number of the day. We'll talk race and economic mobility, and we'll take a trip to the mall. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 3rd of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, they tell you in radio school not to use a whole lot of numbers in your story because numbers going by you real fast does not help you, the humble listener, figure out what's going on. I didn't do real well in school, so we're going to have some numbers here today. You ready? This morning, we got what appeared to be some pretty good news. First-time unemployment claims fell last week on a seasonally adjusted basis. They fell by 130,000 to 881,000 people having lost their jobs, the lowest number that's been since this whole thing started back in March, and only the second time it's been under a million. But let me back up for a minute here. That phrase, seasonally adjusted claims. This week, for the first time, the Labor Department adjusted its seasonal adjustment. That does make the data more accurate, yes, but also more confusing. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is going to make it less confusing.
What's the point of a seasonal adjustment?
So economists use seasonal adjustments to smooth out seasonal patterns to get a better read of the underlying trends in the labor market.
Heidi Shierholz was chief economist at the Labor Department during the Obama administration.
You know, every year in January, 100,000 extra people apply for unemployment insurance claims because they lost temporary holiday jobs. You wouldn't want economists to all of a sudden say, things in the economy are really deteriorating. When they're not, it was just a normal seasonal pattern.
So the statisticians at the Labor Department apply seasonal adjustment formulas to reveal the underlying trends. But a pandemic with more than 20 million layoffs over a few weeks, this stuff is pretty unprecedented. And the traditional methodology for seasonal adjustment of the data
have been messed up.
So the Bureau of Labor Statistics stepped up to fix the methodology. Joseph Bruzuelas at RSM Consulting explains.
And so they moved from doing what we called a multiplicative seasonal adjustment to an additive seasonal adjustment. And I'll stop there before I put everybody to sleep.
But BLS didn't apply the fix retroactively to previous weeks, meaning we don't really know if claims just fell by 130,000. It's like comparing apples and oranges. Bruzuelas says there is a better number to follow right now, the total number of workers getting an unemployment check every week. It's around 29 million, and it's gradually been coming down. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
One of the things holding up whatever Congress may or may not do on an economic relief plan is whether there is going to be help for states and cities whose sales tax revenues have fallen hard during this pandemic because we're just not going out to restaurants and bars and stores like the way we used to. In a lot of states, though, that drop has not been as big as expected, or revenues have actually increased thanks to a 2018 Supreme Court decision. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has that one.
You were always supposed to pay taxes on the stuff you bought online. But until recently, states could not require online retailers to collect those taxes.
Individuals who purchased goods were expected to keep track of the untaxed items they purchased and remit to the state.
Jared Walczak at the Tax Foundation says, as you might imagine,
compliance was incredibly low. Barely anyone did it.
So states were losing hundreds of millions of dollars in taxes a year. But in 2018, the Supreme Court ruled that states could pass legislation requiring online retailers to collect taxes on their behalf. Turns out that came at a good time. Glenn Hager is controller for the state of Texas.
With the pandemic and so many people staying home, that has caused a significant increase in the amount of purchases that are online.
People are buying laptops and bike shorts and patio furniture online. And before this 2018 decision, Texas would not have collected taxes on most of those purchases. The state estimated it would bring in an additional $500 million a year because of this ruling. It's actually collecting double that. And in Kansas, tax revenues are up by 9% compared to this time last year, in part because of this decision.
I think it's actually helping the states quite a bit.
That's Lucy DeDion at the Urban Institute. She says a lot of states are still seeing their tax revenues drop overall. Like in Texas, they're down by almost 3.5% this fiscal year. I'm Mariel Segarra, for Marketplace.
Traders on Wall Street kind of rolled over today. Setting so many all-time highs gets exhausting. I guess we'll have the details when we do the numbers. We got to thinking the other day, what with all the talk about retail in this economy, about a woman who is real close to retail, a whole bunch of retail, in fact, running as she does the Butte Plaza Mall in Butte, Montana. Alana Furco is her name. Alana, it is good to have you back on. How are you?
I'm good. We're all getting through the same thing, aren't we?
We kind of are, but you know, the interesting thing about it is it's different depending on where you live. And I gather in Butte, it's not been terrible, and you guys are getting back to some kind of business and things as normal, yeah?
I will say we are blessed. It has not been terrible. None of us can say that we're embracing any sense of normal, but we are rebuilding some of our routines.
So are all the stores in the mall open now? I mean, do you have people coming in and all of that?
We have people coming in. We're waiting for one of our restaurants to reopen. He's reopening hopefully this week for takeout. Our theater opened, but then all of the movies were pretty stale, so they closed. But they are reopening again on this Friday. So yeah. We're doing the best we can.
What about a regular feature of our conversations? Are those folks who come and walk the mall, are they still there?
I actually have suspended walking until
We
are in our phase three. That has been the hardest thing. It has been super hard. These people are my friends. A lot of them I saw more than I see some of my family. This has been hard. But the silver lining is the weather has been beautiful, which is good for them. I mean, especially considering the circumstances where, you know, a lot of people are suffering a little bit of depression. So.
Yeah,
send them outside to get some sunshine.
What's foot traffic like, though? I mean, not the walkers, but people actually coming in to shop. Are your tenant stores able to do what they need to do to keep going?
They are. They actually are. And there has been the recommitment to shop local. So our jewelry stores are doing well. Our Hallmark. We've got one store that sells, I don't know if I should say their name, but they sell hand soaps and good smelly stuff. They are doing extremely well.
Okay. Good. Well, good. I'm glad they're doing well. All right, so that's the stores. What about the consumers? I mean, I'm sure you have mask requirements and all of that, and you are in charge of managing a public space. Are people following the rules?
They are. People have just been so gracious. Every once in a while, you'll have to remind someone. But, you know, still, it's a choice. If you choose not to wear a mask, you also choose not to come inside.
Boom. That's the rule. Right?
That's the rule. That's the rule. Yes.
Fair enough.
And our governor did mandate masks on July 15th, but actually we enacted our own mask requirement earlier than that when we opened on April 27th.
Hmm.
We all decided it was the best thing, especially if it kept us from getting shut down again.
Good. Good, good. Well, we'll talk to you in a couple of months, Alana, all right?
Okay. Stay well. Be healthy.
You too. Talk to you soon. Alana Furco at the Butte Plaza Mall. A lot of industries, a lot of them, have been forced to face up to their lack of diversity, especially in the top ranks. In healthcare, that's a double whammy. Denied opportunities, of course, for those people, but also healthcare denied in the persistent and well-documented disparities that Black Americans have to deal with when they go see the doctor. Blake Farmer reports now from WPLN in Nashville, where the leading industry in town, yeah, it's not music, it's healthcare.
In Nashville's dominant healthcare sector, Chris Poole is one of the few Black entrepreneurs. He leads a startup that supports new nurse practitioners. Before that, he worked in venture capital.
Given where society was when healthcare got started in this town, there isn't really anyone who looks like me who's in that circle.
That power circle was only white men when HCA started here in 1968. It's grown into the nation's largest hospital chain, valued at more than $45 billion. Hundreds of local firms trace their roots to the company, the family tree, they call it. The racial barriers are harder to see these days. On two occasions, Poole says recruiters wanted him for senior roles. Then the companies picked people he says were less qualified but had connections, like a membership to Nashville's most exclusive country club.
These things happen, and they happen a lot. Now, was it overt racism? It's so difficult to sort of nail down such an absolute conclusion.
What Poole can say is that Nashville's healthcare leaders love to do business with people they know, and they're usually white men. It's a fact that's obvious to Haley Hovius, president of the Nashville Healthcare Council.
You can't walk into a healthcare council event without thinking that to yourself.
During her tenure, Hovius, who is white, has hired more black women and launched programs to develop diverse leaders, but that hasn't resulted in changes to the council's powerful board of directors. It has fewer people of color than at points in the past.
And it's pretty clear that there's a lot more work that we need to do.
The concerns extend beyond corporate diversity. This is an industry that has a direct effect on health and longevity, and many black patients have not fared well. Dwayne Reynolds of Just Health Collective advises healthcare companies on diversity policies. He says the for-profit healthcare industry was founded not long after hospitals had to desegregate.
And as a result, hospitals and health systems still may retain policies, procedures, and processes that inadvertently leads to health disparities.
Examples abound. Studies are finding that black people have a harder time getting COVID-19 tests. Reynolds links that to healthcare facilities locating in more affluent communities.
From a business standpoint, that makes logical sense.
But from an equity perspective, Reynolds, who's black, says catering to white patients has done more than contribute to COVID-19's lopsided impacts. It also plays a role in higher rates of chronic conditions and maternal mortality.
More than anywhere, this industry needs to reflect America.
Bobby Frist, who is white, is the chairman of the Nashville Healthcare Council and a literal part of its family tree. His uncle and grandfather started HCA. The publicly traded company he founded, HealthStream, decided to put out a statement condemning the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis and acknowledging deep racial inequities. Frist considers it a first step.
We know there are laws that create equality, but we're not through implicit bias. We're not through the concept of white privilege.
HCA also just released a lengthy plan to accelerate diversity initiatives in its 180 hospitals. But it shouldn't take nationwide protest to see what needs changing, says entrepreneur Marcus Whitney. He published an essay in June about his own struggle launching healthcare companies in Nashville and requiring a white partner to see much success.
Like, whatever the efforts are, whatever is going on, whatever our standards of success are as it pertains to diversity, equity, and inclusion, it's not hitting the mark.
Healthcare is so important to the economy that Whitney says the country as a whole can't achieve more racial equity until this vital industry does. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I had to come to terms with myself and either see where I was as an obstacle or as an opportunity.
Which takes a whole lot of work. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, the Wawas. You knew they were coming. Dow Industrials ended the day down 807 points, 2.7%, 28,292. The NASDAQ down 598 points, that is 4.9%. Finished at 11,458. The S&P 500 off 125 points, 3.5%, 34.55 there. Tech companies are one reason for the bad day on Wall Street today. Apple down 8%, Microsoft down 6%, along with Amazon, which gave back 4.6%. Zoom, which earlier in the week had a big day's surge of 40%, they were down 10% today. Campbell Soup saw a surge in demand the first half of the year, especially as people stocked up on canned foods, including soup and pasta sauces. Not anymore. Campbell Soup down 7.4% today. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Farming is where we go next to something called the Ag Economy Barometer, put together by Purdue University and the CME Group, which runs, among other things, a whole lot of agricultural commodity trading exchanges. Anyway, farmers were feeling a lot better about farming in August than they did in June and July. As I said, a lot better. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore tells us why.
Farmers have suffered this year. Restaurants stopped buying for a while, meatpacking plants shut down, crop prices fell, and throw in some natural disasters.
These last several months have been super tense.
Dale Moore is Executive Vice President of the American Farm Bureau Federation. Now farmers are a little more positive.
Doesn't necessarily mean that they're jumping up and down and shooting off the fireworks. But certainly it's like, okay, I can see a little bit of sunshine on this.
Ray of sunshine number one is trade, according to Michael Langemeyer, professor of agricultural economics at Purdue.
We've heard more positive news, particularly in relationship to China, buying soybeans in particular. That's really improved sentiment.
Ray of sunshine number two, prices.
Farmers are paying attention to prices. That's the big deal going on here.
Dan Sumner is professor of agricultural economics at UC Davis. Corn prices rose in August, in part because poor growing conditions limited supply, benefiting farmers in the Midwest. But as the economy improved, crop prices have been good to farmers elsewhere, too, including in California, which produces more crops in dollar terms than any other state.
Hog prices have come back. Cattle prices come back a bit. Milk prices came back a lot.
Government payouts to farmers have been important, and Sumner says the economic downturn actually pushed some unemployed workers into agriculture, so labor shortages weren't as bad as some farmers feared. Of course, all the momentum that farmers may be feeling now could evaporate if coronavirus surges again in the fall or winter. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Back in 2016, we took a reporting trip to the Mississippi Delta to talk about race and poverty and economic mobility. And in a little town called Cleveland, Mississippi, we met Chiquita Fountain and her son, Maurice.
Hi, Chiquita, around, please. Hi.
Cleveland's one of those towns in the South where money gets funneled into certain places and not to others, and where opportunity exists for some people but not for others. Chiquita saw that every single day working for a youth services group.
What do they tell you about their opportunities here?
Basically, that there are none. That if they stay here, they feel trapped. That if they do choose to go to school and pursue a college degree, that there's no guarantee that they will get a job once they graduate. So they opt to leave.
That stuck in Chiquita's mind so much so that back in 2016, when we were talking, she was thinking about leaving and finding opportunities someplace else, and so was Maurice.
Where do you see yourself in like 10 years?
Just anywhere besides here. Like, there's a lot of places that are way better than Cleveland. They have like the little bump sticker, "Keep Cleveland Boring."
Yeah, I've seen it. You don't want boring.
Mm-mm. I want something that grabs my attention.
He was in eighth grade back then, by the way. But anyway, here we are. 4 years later, Chiquita is now the executive director of a community nonprofit organization called Delta Hands for Hope. And we thought this might be a good time to get her back on the phone. Chiquita Fountain, it is so good to talk to you again.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me again.
Talk to me about you for a minute. You have now a different job than you did 4 years ago. You're working in a nonprofit about community, and that's part of why I wanted to get you back on the phone. How much of an impact has the pandemic had on you? I mean, you're pushing forward. We're all trying, but come on, brass tacks, how you doing?
Yes. This situation has only exacerbated a problem that was already prevalent in our community to begin with, and that's poverty and the mindset of poverty. And to see how this pandemic has, first of all, taken children out of school, it has altered their way of life. How they go about receiving education. And a lot of our families rely heavily on schools, not just for education, but for food. So it's been really challenging when you're working with a community that is so used to not receiving love and support. So it's been a lot. It's been a lot.
You are, I get the sense of it, and we didn't talk about this last time, but you are fundamentally, it sounds like, an optimistic person. And I wonder whether you are hopeful now as well, given everything that's going on.
I am. I'm hopeful now because our young generations are seeing how important it is to work together, that we get this done. And so the fact that they have taken a hold of this, that they see how important it is to vote, they see how important civic engagement is. It just brings my heart joy because these young people now see how important ownership and accountability is. So when you say, yes, I'm a hopeful person, I am. And I'm just really just praying that they see how they can impact the world even in such a small rural area.
So let's talk about the youth, and let's talk about your youth, your son Maurice, who is clearly just your joy. You can hear it in your voice.
Absolutely.
last time we were there, he was 13 or something. He's going to be a senior in high school now. Apparently he's athletic and smart and wants to go places. When we were there in 2016, you two said you had been talking about leaving the Delta for better opportunities. And he said, I want to get out of here. And it sounds like now what's happened is that you have become reinvested in your community where you are.
Yes.
And I guess what I want to know is, what's Maurice thinking? Because he's at a decision point now, or will be real soon.
Absolutely. And to be honest with you, as it relates to college, he still wants to leave. But when I talked to you in 2016, I was I wasn't happy with a lot of the things that were going on in regards to my career and where I felt I should be and where I wanted to go in my life. So I had to come to terms with myself and either see where I was as an obstacle or as an opportunity. So I decided to start seeing it as an opportunity. And from that point, I made it my mission to empower every young mother that had a young child, that wanted to go back to school, that wanted to change jobs, or wanted to find ways to volunteer and become more engaged in their community. And I started taking Maurice with me when I started going out and doing community engagements, getting him more involved in his community and what's going on. And not to say that those things altered or changed, you know, his wishes or, you know, desires to leave. But I do, you know, just emphasize to him the importance of finding who he is and what he wants to do with his life, but never forget about how he can use those experiences and who he is, that journey, to help someone else.
That was Chiquita Fountain in Cleveland, Mississippi. My conversation with her was part of an hour-long Marketplace special that we did about systemic racism in this economy and what the way forward might look like. That special and the one that David did on The Morning Show and Molly did on Marketplace Tech, they all live online, marketplace.org. Click on the specials tab right at the top of the page. This final note on the way out today, the New York Times reports this afternoon that the Justice Department is set to file antitrust charges against Google and soon, too. Attorney General William Barr, over the objections, the Times says, of career lawyers at the Department of Justice, wants charges brought as soon as the end of this month. Yes, there are politics here, but also, I mean, it is tough to do almost anything online without Google touching you at some point, you know? All right, we are out of here, but not without your moment of economic context for this Thursday. It is the Global Trade Edition. Hey, do you remember the trade deficit? Back in the day, it was President Trump's favorite, if misguided, economic indicator. Part of the reason we got into a trade war with China, in fact, and it's still going on, was because we were buying so much more from them than they were selling to us. Anyway, we learned this morning the overall trade gap in July jumped almost 20% over a month earlier to its highest level in almost 12 years. The trade gap with China up almost 12%. Now, there is nothing sinister in that. We send them money, they send us stuff. That's the way trade works. Okay, that's it. Amir Bibawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.